Merry meet. My name is Ariel, and this is A Witch's Primer, Basic Training in Non-Denominational Witchcraft. Join in the discussion at thedcw.999.org. That's thedcw.999.org. Blessed be. Welcome back. It has been much, much too long, and I am so happy to be back. I have been extremely busy and have not had the time that I need to do my podcasting. So hopefully here's to a little bit more regularity before I go out of town again. Okay, I want to answer a few questions. I'm going to change the way that I deal with questions. I know some people that post on the forum prefer not to have their questions be aired on the podcast. So if you have a question that you would like me to tackle for the benefit of everybody listening on the podcast, go ahead and either email that to me. You can email that to ariel@thedcw.org, or you can private message me off the forum. And the forum is thedcw.999.org. So if you want, I would love to have your questions come in that we can put on the podcast. But just to make sure that everybody feels comfortable, we're going to limit the questions that I actually answer on the podcast to those people who actually ask me a question directly and give me permission to put it on the podcast. All right, so I have a series of questions from one such person, and I'm going to try pronouncing this name. Thigalian? I have no idea if I did that right. Anyway, he's a male, and he was very kind to tell me that he's a male, and he has several questions, and we will go ahead and answer them to the best of my ability, one at a time. All right, so it says, in one of your Witch's Primer podcasts, you talked about a witch's word being his or her bond. If you say that you are going to do something, then you do it. So you have to be careful about committing yourself. And then he goes on to say that the nature of his work means that schedule changes quite quickly and deadlines get moved. And then he says, if I have committed to going to a networking event or seminar, but the demands of a client change such that I cannot really attend the event and satisfy the client's demands at that same time, does it mean that I have undermined my willpower if I back out of the event? Or is it fair to say that I have new information since committing to the event? This excuse smacks somewhat of sophistry to me, but it is difficult to see a way around the problem. Well, I can tell you the way around the problem. When you make the commitment, you make the commitment with the caveat that your schedule is very fluid and that you may not be able to be there. So that's the way that you can maintain the integrity of your word, and knowing that it's very possible that you won't be able to be there. So you can say something to the effect of, I can go ahead and schedule this appointment with you, but please understand that I may have to cancel, and I promise that I will give you as much notice as possible if I do have to cancel. And then that way they can say, yes, I agree with that, or no, I don't agree with that. But either way, your word is still your word. You haven't promised something that you were unable to deliver. Hopefully that makes sense and is doable for you. Also, he says, I appreciate the comments you have made about visualization. It is clearly a topic which affects many people, judging by the comments on the forum. What seems strange to me is that visualizing while I'm going about my normal activities can be quite easy, but as soon as I get to the room where I do my practice, something gets in the way. Are there any tips you have for dealing with this? Well, I'm sure other people on the forum will have their own input as well, and I'm not the end all, but just my opinion is if it's easier for you to visualize when you're out and about doing things, then you're probably, when you're out and about doing things, you have less, putting less pressure on yourself, and it's more of a game. So you have to find some way that you can recreate that same feeling when you're doing your actual magical work, when you're at your altar or whatever, that you can just say, I'm going to, you know, give it my best. I'm going to do my best effort. Really, visualization to me, there's so much put on it. And I do agree that the visuals are important. I do think that picturing is important. I'm not saying that it's not, but the feeling that you get, I think, is more important than the pictures. So if you're doing a visualization, say for a spell that involves, getting, maybe booking 5 new clients next week. Rather, if you weren't able to see that happening very clearly, but you were able to create the feeling of what it would feel like if you had 5 new clients, that would do the job. If you could focus on that feeling. And 9 times out of 10, I've experienced with students that if they're able to get the feeling, that the visual actually is a lot easier because they're in a sort of an exalted state. So hopefully that sort of speaks to your question a little bit. Okay, several questions here. I'm going to go right through them here. How much should one allow one's practice to impinge on daily life? I appreciate the importance of coming back to the, quote, real world after finishing meditation or other spiritual practices. But does this mean that one should never allow the, quote, real world and the spiritual to mix? If one is facing a stressful situation at work or in one's home, is it acceptable to switch on one's spiritual energies, as it were, and access things like the elemental bodies or the spirit body, if that helps? You know, if I ever gave the impression that I expected people to have a very clear-cut division between their mundane world and their spiritual world, I do apologize. I don't believe in that at all. There's definitely a time and a place for certain spiritual activities. I mean, you don't want to get into a trance while you're driving or operating machinery. You don't want to make other people around you unnecessarily uncomfortable by performing magic in front of them. You know, obvious magic and doing invocations, incantations, you know, sprinkling powders and things like that. But absolutely, if you can find a way to switch into magical mode to get the job done within the machinations of your daily life, that's the goal. We want this to be practical. Absolutely. This is not something that is, you know, that's sort of reserved for church on Sunday. You should be able to live a magical life. It should be the way you live. That's not to say that you don't do your spiritual practice every day, but that spiritual practice empowers and informs your so-called mundane world. So absolutely, that's why one of the reasons why I recommend that you have at least some sort of spiritual practice in the morning, in addition to if you like to do something at night, because I think that in the morning, if you're able to do your magical practice in the morning, that it sort of tweaks you. It sort of aligns you and sets the tone of your whole day so that when situations arise, you're more well equipped to deal with them from a magical perspective. So I hope that answers your question. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. All right. Let's see. My final question. These are great questions, by the way. My final question has to do with what might be called time in grade. In the Witch's Primer, you gave instructions for developing the elemental bodies over a period of 5 weeks. Other traditions suggest longer periods in a grade, 6 months or more, while the different bodies are being developed. Is it your experience that these lengthy periods are not required? Well, I don't know that many people that actually do the elemental bodies as I do them. I don't think that that's super common. It's just sort of a construct that I've sort of created. Maybe other people do it and I'm not aware of it, but this is again, the build, this is the building of your power base to like the building of a witch's, the witch's pyramid. And, you know, you can take as long as you want. This, I suggest a minimum of 1 week per body to get things going. But at the same time, there's a danger of always preparing to do magic and never actually doing anything. I think that, that getting enough work done to build your power base so that you can actually obtain some results will fuel your enthusiasm to want to come back and do some more and do some more. So that's different from, say, a period of initiatory training, which lasts usually a minimum of a year per degree. This is not an initiatory training, and we're not going to, this is not a substitution for an initiatory path, but it is a good adjunct to that. This training is a self-study course in practical, non-denominational witchcraft that can be used by anybody, whether or not they belong to a tradition or whether they have any sort of religious affiliation whatsoever, or people that have a Wiccan affiliation, or people that are Druids, or people that are Catholics, or people that are Baha'i. I don't really care. This should be able to be used by anybody who wants to use it to obtain positive results in their life. So I would prefer to give you a training that's usable and not something that's... The thing about an initiatory path is usually you have... And I've done a lot of this, but usually you have a group or a mentor on site with you to help you through it, because some of that can get very arduous, some of it can get very tedious, some of it can get extremely boring. You know, there's definitely peaks and valleys to an initiatory path of training, and there's good initiatory paths, and there's some really freaky initiatory paths out there too. Just because someone says that they're going to initiate you doesn't necessarily mean that you want to be initiated into what they're doing either. So there's pros and cons to working an initiatory path, but one of the reasons why it's easier to do a long term path like that, training like that, one-on-one, is that you're less likely to quit because somebody's there to help you through it. So hopefully that helps. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about casting a magical circle. I'm going to take you through the basic text of my book for casting a magic circle. I have changed my mind on a lot of this stuff, and I will post the text in the forum so that you can download it so you can use it. But as we go through, I'm going to give you my opinions of why I agree or disagree with what I wrote, because some of the stuff I think I don't necessarily follow anymore. Some of it I think I've moved beyond. Okay, but here we go. So this is casting a circle. In the craft, whenever we work our magic, we do it in a sanctified space. We don't need special temples, although some witches do enjoy such things. Any place on earth can be purified and made holy for magical ceremonies. We can create a temple on the spot. And this is done by casting a magic circle. And a magic circle is cast by defining an area, cleansing it off, sealing it off, and then empowering it with specific energy. It's sort of like creating a womb out of which magical children, which are our spells, are born. I recommend that most magic be done in a magic circle. Now, that's what the book says. I don't agree with that anymore. I think that you can do magic in or out of a circle as you feel drawn to do. Sometimes very, very powerful spells can be done outside of a magic circle. I don't think that your daily practice needs to be done inside of a magic circle unless you decide to do so, because sometimes the idea of casting a circle can be so... you know, tedious that you say, "Oh, forget it. I don't even want to bother. I'd much rather you do the magic and then, and reserve the circles for when you feel like you really need, that special sanctified space and, or are working in a group." Okay. So at first you might find casting a circle a bit confusing and intimidating, but just be patient and work with it for a while and you will get the hang of it. In fact, a good idea for beginners is to work with casting a circle once per day until it becomes fluid and seamless. And for the first week or two, you may want to even break it down into sections, practicing each section separately. And then for the next couple of weeks, try putting all the pieces together, then memorize the whole thing and work with it for another week or so. Perhaps then you would like to improvise on the ritual, add to it a little bit, and make it your own. Before we begin the discussion of casting the actual circle, let's spend a few moments considering circle etiquette when you're working in a group. So if you're working with a group or you're a guest at a circle, in the time just prior to casting a circle, it's expected that all people present are going to be quiet and reflective, meditative, avoiding the joking and arguing, noise-making. Often a period of silence is observed. If you do have to communicate at this time, please do so quietly, whisper it, sign language it, or move out of the area. Once a circle has been cast, it's usually not okay for you to cross that boundary of the circle without asking the priest or priestess to cut a door for you or a portal through you so that you can get out. It's usually impolite to talk during a circle until an informal period, like during cakes and wine. Obviously, you're not going to touch any magical tools without asking for permission. People get touchy about that. Some witches put personal energy into their tools, and they're just not some. Most of us do. They're not going to be comfortable with people handling it. It's just rude to handle people's tools without permission. If you're going up to the altar to consecrate an item as part of the ritual, it's acceptable to place the article on the pentacle usually, especially if they tell you it's okay. Pass it through the incense, smoke, sprinkle water on it, touch it to the salt, whatever. For the most part, you're going to be walking sunwise in a circle unless they've told you otherwise. Sunwise is known as diosil in the craft. It's actually pronounced jeezel, but nobody will know what the heck you're talking about if you say, oh, are we going jeezel? They'll say, what? Diosil is how it's spelled. So most people, English-speaking people, will say diosil, but the Gaelic is pronounced jeezel. Sunwise. So in the northern hemisphere, sunwise is clockwise. In the southern hemisphere, sunwise is counterclockwise. Whoever's running the ritual will usually tell you if that's a big deal. Sometimes they don't care. Sometimes people don't mind what way you walk. But if they want you to move sunwise, do so. The sacred fire is present. You don't throw your cigarette butts or gum wrappers or trash in there. In fact, you don't put anything into a sacred fire unless you're instructed to do so, because it's a sacred fire. Okay, so there's many techniques for casting circles, and I'm going to give you a ritual that's sort of involved and long, and this is sort of like the whole Megillah. This is the whole enchilada. You can do very, very simple circles on your own. In fact, the orb of light exercise is a type of circle. You could take your athame and just trace a circle around the boundary of the place that you're going to be working, visualizing a bluish white light moving through the athame tip and on the ground around you, and that's your circle. It can be that simple. You could also use a wand for that. In fact, I recommend you try doing it with a blade, and then try doing it with a wand, and notice the difference on two different occasions. Obviously, notice the difference in energy when you use those two tools, and both of them are appropriate. Usually, we're going to cast our circles jeezel or diosil. I'm going to go ahead and say diosil for the rest of the podcast because that's what most people understand. Okay. Anti-sunwise is known as withershins or widdershins. And obviously that's counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere. The southern hemisphere, that would be clockwise. Okay, so the basic steps to casting the circle that I'm going to give you are arranged in a particular order so as to optimize the desired results. I will further elaborate on each of the steps in order and then give a complete ceremony as an exercise at the end. And again, I'm going to include that as a handout. So you're going to start off with grounding and centering. Then you're going to cleanse the area, purify it. Then you're going to create an energy boundary. You're going to call the watchtowers. Then you're going to raise a cone of power. Usually raising power is done as a cone of power. You're going to optionally invoke a deity if you're working with a deity. Then you're going to do the work, whatever you're doing work for. Then we usually have libations, especially if we're working in a group. If you've invoked a deity, you're gonna thank them. And then after that, you're going to bring the cone down. You're going to close the watchtowers. You're going to banish the circle boundary. And then you're going to do a final grounding and centering. Now, you know how to do the grounding and centering, but we're going to go through that again. The purpose of grounding and centering, as the name would imply, is twofold. Grounding means to relax the body and rid it of all excess tension while linking up to a power source so as to avoid depleting our own energy. This source is often the earth. Centering refers to the balancing of the energy that is running through the body once it is grounded. It's imperative that you ground and center thoroughly before attempting to perform any kind of magic. And you can use the meditation that I've given you, or if you have another one that you like, then use that one. Preparation prior to performing the actual grounding and centering might be necessary. The ritual bath is customary. And actually, it helps. It actually starts the grounding process because it's very relaxing. The water should be warm and enjoyable. And don't forget to put some salt and maybe some essential oil of hyssop or lavender, if you like, in there. While in the bath, you might want to go over the events of your day to sort of complete your day and make sure that you don't bring any of your tensions of the day in with you, because tension in the mind and the body regarding persons and events and conditions have to dissolve and fade. And then you can just see them dissolve and fade and drain out with the bathwater. Then you're all refreshed and peaceful and happy and ready. I don't recommend that you rush through this step if you have the ability to take a ritual bath. I think it's very important. If you don't have access to a bathtub, like if you live in an apartment where you either don't have one or the tub is too small, you could actually do this in your shower. And again, you can scrub down with real, real finely ground sea salt to exfoliate your skin and also clean your aura. And then once you've showered off, then you might want to do a little bit of a relaxation before you start your grounding and centering. If you're working with others, then it's important that all present be harmonious. So you want to make sure that you've resolved any interpersonal conflicts and problems prior to showing up for your ritual. Bringing personal tensions into a circle is bad enough, but bringing tensions regarding others present is very painful for everyone involved, and it's really inexcusable. The general rule is that if you can't meet in perfect love and perfect trust, then go ahead and stay home. This, of course, doesn't mean that you have to be best friends with everyone present, but you must be able to maintain a high degree of relaxation and mutual respect for everyone in the circle. Most traditions have some sort of meeting dance or ceremony to help bring all of the individuals present into one cohesive group mind. And this ceremony usually includes anointing with an oil. If you are not in a group, you can also anoint with an oil. If you're using essential oil, make sure that you dilute it with a carrier oil. You only need a drop or two of essential oil within a half ounce to an ounce of carrier oil. It doesn't have to be highly fragrant, and it shouldn't sting your skin, especially if you're using something very volatile, like a wintergreen oil or cinnamon. Forget it. I mean, cinnamon, you've really got to dilute. But anyway, once you've got your anointing oil, you can anoint just the third eye point between your eyes if you want, or you can anoint all your chakra points. Yes, I know shucker is the right word, but everybody knows what chakra is. Most people don't understand when I say shucker. Okay, so then you want to cleanse the aura prior to entering your circle. And if you're doing it at home, you've already done that in your bath. But if you do your bath at home and then you go to the ritual space and you're doing it within a group, then you want to do another little cleansing with everybody before you start the circle. And just smudge. You just take a smudge stick or a thurible with some purification incense and smudge everybody down. And you can also sprinkle everybody with salt and water. And you can even do that as they enter the circle, or you can do everybody at once and then cast a circle around them, however you're going to do it. Once purified, you can do your anointing, as we said. Okay. Each participant... I already talked about that. Never mind. Okay, so usually the priestess and priestess will do the purification and anointing as participants enter the circle, with the purification preceding the anointing. But if you're just doing impromptu, or if you're not into having priests and priestesses and you're in a group, you can help everybody do one little part of the ceremony. That's fine. Okay, once our stated purpose in casting a magic circle, one of our stated purposes of casting a magic circle is to sanctify. So the space in which we are working is to be purified. And remember that we are usually interested in creating a temporary temple for our magical work to be performed. And this means that the space in question is usually probably used for other purposes, which could be described as mundane. Therefore, we desire to eliminate from the area all vibrations that are not compatible with our goal. So to accomplish this, we incorporate the same principles of purification that were discussed in the exercises dealing with the consecration of your tools, the purification of the four elements. So each of the four elements used for purification, salt, water, incense, are separately placed on the pentacle and charged with an electric blue light. If you don't feel, now this is, again, this is the most elaborate way to do it, where you actually take each thing one at a time and consecrate it on your pentacle. You could also just consecrate everything at once and stick some salt in your water and put some charcoal on your, put some incense on your charcoal and call it happy, and you'll do fine. When the four elements are combined into pairs, incense on the coal, salt in the water, then the purification begins. We want to begin in the center of where your circle is going to be cast. So right in the apex, right in the center, right in the center of where you're going to be doing it. First with the salt water, and then with the smoking incense, you're going to be moving diesel, I keep doing that to you. You're going to be moving diesel, spiraling out for a total of three circuits, but you can do however many you feel are necessary to purify that space. But I think three is a good number. So you're going to start in the center and spiral outward to the circumference of where you're going to be casting your circle. So the salt water is sprinkled and the incense is wafted while chanting and visualizing the bluish white light. And this color is the same as the Bunsen burner color. You can use a chant, like we've done before, fire and air, this charge I give, no spell nor unknown purpose live, that kind of thing. Fire and air, the charge I lay, no spell nor unknown purpose stay. And you know the score. We've done these before. Or you can make up your own chant while you're doing your purification. Okay, once the area is purified, then we want to keep it that way. So we seal it off with a boundary of energy. The boundary serves as a protection against unwanted energy and vibrations, and a means by which the power rays can be contained. So it's a twofold thing. It protects and it contains. The tool often used for this operation is the athame, although you can also use a wand. And like I said, I would try both ways and see which one works better for which situation. You need to experiment. You can also just use your fingers. You can use the index and middle finger of the hand that you eat with. So some traditions specify what the diameter of a circle should be, while others allow the circle to accommodate the size of the space and the amount of the participants. I don't personally care. I don't think that the measurement necessarily is that important unless you're doing a particular kind of ceremonial magic, which is not what we're talking about here. So once your circle is cast, then you don't want to cross the boundary, because if you cross the boundary, then you are dissipating the integrity of the circle, and then your circle casting procedures will become less and less effective as time goes on because you're not taking it seriously. So sometimes people actually want to mark the boundary of the circle on the ground before casting it. So that can be done with chalk, masking tape, or outdoors, or salt even. You know, it's a lot of salt, so make sure you have a good vacuum cleaner. Or in the outdoors, it could be marked in the sand or the dirt, or we've used pine cones, you know, to mark the boundary of the circle. It's kind of fun to actually do that, but it's not necessary. Once the location of where the boundary shall be cast is established, the witch performing the operation stands at the perimeter outside of where the circle is going to be cast, facing out. The blade is pointing down at the ground, or the wand, but I'm going to say the blade, pointing down at the ground where she wants to begin to draw her energy boundary, and it's going to be usually in the east or the north. Drawing upon the power source with which she linked at her grounding and centering, she feels the power rising up through her body and out through her arm through the tip of her athame. Seeing the energy clearly shoot to the ground, she then walks diocel, I said it the way I said I was going to say it, around the entire perimeter of the circle, chanting her conjuration while continuing to see the blue light fall into the circle pattern she has previously chosen to draw. She ends by overlapping a bit with her starting point to make sure there are no gaps. Once the sacred space has been sealed, everyone present takes a moment to just visualize it clearly in their minds before proceeding. Now, like I said, where you're overlapping it, you could start, like if you're starting your casting in the east, you can actually start it in the northeast. If you're going clockwise, if you're in the northern hemisphere, and then when you end up in the east, you've overlapped it a little bit. There's another little tool that some people like to use when you finish that, is you draw a figure eight on its side, a circle of infinity. They call it a knot of infinity, where you see that the two strands of that circle join one another in that knot of infinity. That's another little tool you could use if you like it. Okay, now, calling the watchtowers is the next step. So we are now in a pure, clean, sealed environment, and the next step is to balance and empower the circle by calling on the guardians of the four cardinal points. The four directions, as you may recall from the correspondences on the elements, are sacred to one of the four elements of nature. So the east is sacred to air, the south is sacred to fire, the west water, and the north earth. Now, that's in the northern hemisphere, by the way. If you're in the southern hemisphere, you're going to flip the correspondences for the south and the north. So in the southern hemisphere, the north is sacred to fire and the south is sacred to earth. So it's important to remember that. Okay, so we evoke each of these guardians of the watchtowers by cutting portals into their dimensions. To evoke means to call an entity into a specific space for a limited period of time. To invoke means to call into oneself for an unlimited amount of time, and it's a type of worship. We invoke that which we consider to be higher on the evolutionary scale, and we evoke that which we consider to be our peers, theoretically at least. Okay, so we only perform evocations and invocations for beings who do not possess bodies in this world. In other words, you're not going to invoke or evoke your friend Julie if she's still living. When invoking, we call into our bodies and into our minds an energy we desire to have enter and intermingle into us. So something that we are ascribing to be more like. So that would be goddesses and gods and angels and things like that. When evoking, we give an entity a confined space in which to manifest for a time and then leave, such as the elementals. Incidentally, a trance medium, although calling the spirits of a deceased person into their body, is performing an evocation, not an invocation, because the spirits are only using her body for a limited amount of time, and it's not usually the desire of the medium to worship or become one with these entities. Since each of the elements correspond to a color, colors vary according to the system being operated, it's customary to have a candle of the corresponding elemental color placed at the circle's perimeter at each of those four directions. And if you decide to do this, you want to do that ahead of time as part of the setup. So obviously, if you're in the northern hemisphere, the east is going to be a yellow candle, the south will be a red, the west will be blue, and the north will be green. And if you're that's in the northern hemisphere. If you're in the southern hemisphere, you're going to flip the north and the south. These candles will be lit each separately at the point of evocation to denote the presence of the watchers and as an aid in visualizing the appropriate color for each direction. Now, again, when we say that you're confining, you're finding a confining space for these people, it doesn't mean that you're trapping them. It's not like a, there's not like a Goetic operation where you're confining and trapping them into a triangle of manifestation and where you're going to torture them or something like that. It's more like, it's more like creating, an environment that's friendly to them. It's more like if before you invite people over to your house for a party, you'll want to clean up the house and set it up appropriately so that it has the right atmosphere for people to have the party. So it's a respectful thing, not a not an intimidating thing. So the evocations usually begin either in the east or the north, depending on where you cast your circle. If you started casting your circle in the east, then you're going to want to start your evocation in the east. If you started casting your circle in the north, then you want to start your evocations in the north. Again, if you're in the southern hemisphere, the north and the south are flipped. Okay, so the witch stands before the quarter. Now, it says athame held aloft. I don't do that anymore. I use a wand for evocations for the elementals. I think it's very rude to use a threatening element to the elementals because I am not calling unruly spirits into my circle. I am calling very cooperative, very helpful, very intelligent beings. So I use a wand because it's not a threatening instrument. It's a compelling instrument. But some people disagree and they still recommend using an athame, and that's up to you. Okay, so wand held aloft in silent salute. She speaks her evocation and then draws an evoking pentagram in the air with her athame and charges it with the appropriate colored light. She then lights the quarter candle and moves on to the next quarter, always moving diocel. After all four quarters are called, she stops for a moment at the first quarter in silent salute, while everyone present, if anyone's present besides her, visualizes all four pentagrams in their respective directions, each shining with their appropriate color. Now, you do not have to use a pentagram. You do not have to draw a pentagram if you do not want to. You can, and it's very, very customary. But if you just want to call the quarters without drawing any diagram at all, you may do so. And that's very... that's a very common and very powerful thing. Again, it's you're creating a portal in your mind, so you see like a circle opening up in each direction where the elemental kingdoms are represented. But you can also use that pentagram, and that's very very effective and very powerful. And the instructions for drawing the pentagrams are included in the handout. Okay, then raising power. So after cleansing this space and sealing it off and balancing the energy of the elements, we're ready to raise the power for the magic. It's usually done by what's called raising the cone of power. The cone of power is created with everyone present, unless you're solo, joining hands. Since we want the energy to travel diocel in the circle, we join hands with the right hand up to receive the energy from the person on our right, and the left hand down to give energy to the person on our left. Again, if you're in the southern hemisphere, you would flip that. Unless instructed otherwise, it's necessary that the energy be visualized as pure white light. Most often this power is drawn from the center of the earth into the bodies of the participants and passed clockwise. As the energy moves around faster and faster, more energy is drawn from the earth, causing the energy to rise higher like a wall or sheet of pure light. There is usually a common celestial body that is the goal of the cone, such as the moon or the sun, and everyone visualizes the cone forming a tip, attaching itself to the celestial goal. Everyone takes a moment to visualize the cone and make sure there are no energy gaps, and then the base of the cone is moved back and attached to the perimeter of the circle, where it is anchored firmly there in the minds of all present. Now, again, if you're on your own and you don't have a group, you do that same thing, but you don't have to use your hands up and down. You just visualize that happening through you, and you see the cone forming after you've raised that energy. You see the cone forming around you. There are many, many methods for raising power. Almost always, the methods will include rhythmic breathing. Sometimes sounds or words of power are chanted. Dancing is also used very commonly as a means of raising the cone. Unless a cone is being raised by a solitary practitioner, there is usually one person who's verbally coaching the group during the raising of the cone to ensure that it is raised simultaneously by all present. This is most often done by the acting priest or priestess, or, you know, or whoever you've chosen to do it. The ability to sense group energy and coach a good cone of power requires a sensitivity that comes with experience and practice. Now, again, if you're doing this on your own, which most of you are going to be doing, you can practice different methods of raising energy, such as I described. You can dance. Again, you want to do most of your dancing in the direction that you're wanting the energy to move. So you want to dance Diosil. Or you can do some of that rhythmic breathing, or you can go back and do that rainbow exercise that I gave you earlier, that meditation. That's a great energy raising exercise. Okay, if you are invoking deity, it's important that when performing an invocation, that the deity chosen is one with whom the participants feel very safe. Remember that an invocation is a form of worship whereby the deity is asked to enter into the participants. If one particular pantheon of gods or goddesses doesn't appeal to the group, it's perfectly fine for them to call upon just the Divine Mother and or the Divine Father and leave it at that. Remember that the intelligence, which is responsible for designing and creating the universe, isn't limited to any particular name or form, and it isn't picky about the names used to call upon it. What is important, however, is the attitude with which the deity is approached. When preparing to enter the presence of a deity, one's mental and emotional state should be reverent, peaceful, and eager to receive an exalted, transforming religious experience. It's important that we remember that we love our spiritual parents and are grateful to them that they gave us life, and as such, and that they give us life in the present time. And as such, gratitude and love are the important underlying attitudes necessary for the invocation. Oftentimes, the priest will invoke the father and the priestess the mother, but this is not a rule. Usually, the invocation is a spoken prayer or incantation, either read aloud from the Book of Shadows or from memory, or it can be improvised. These words are only a catalyst for the mind and emotions, which is where the invocation really occurs. Once the invocation has been spoken, all present take some time to accept the presence into them and surrender unto its power. To some, the idea of surrender is a frightening one or a distasteful one, but in reality, deity exists inside of us as our own higher minds. Therefore, it's important to remember that we are only surrendering to the highest principle within ourselves and the universe, and we are already a part of this. Thereby, we are letting go of the mental and emotional garbage that is keeping us unhappy, and that's what I mean by surrender. Again, if you do not ascribe to a religious perspective and you don't want to do deities, just omit that step. Doing the work. This is the part of the circle that is the one in which the most variation occurs. It is the heart of the ritual, the main purpose for creating the space in the first place. It can be a guided visualization, it can be a spell, it can just be a quiet meditation time, it can be a celebration, a mystery play, a storytelling, it could be music, it could be all kinds of things. The list is endless. As you involve yourself more and more with the craft, the ideas of the types of work in which witches can do in a circle will become much more apparent to you. If you're working within a group, these activities will be presented as part of your training. If you do not have a teacher or group yet, start with some simple meditations at first and some spell work, that kind of thing. Soon you'll be coming up with creative ideas for ritual work of your own. Remember, if the creative process is not involved, it's not magic. Okay, next comes libations. The libations served within a witch's magic circle are traditionally cakes and wine, although almost any kind of food or drink is appropriate. Please remember when working in a group that some people may not partake of alcoholic beverages, so it's important when serving wine, the non-alcoholic beverage be offered as well. Also, some present may be vegetarians, so you may want to take that into account. So figure all that stuff out. Try to get a sense of who's going to be present if you're in a group, and make sure that your libations address the needs of your group. Okay, the libations are blessed in the name of the deities present, if any. Otherwise, they're just blessed. After everyone is served, all will toast the Lord and Lady if they're present, and then as they partake, realize that they are eating and drinking with them. Usually a small libation is served within the circle, and if a feast or potluck is to take place, it usually occurs shortly after the circle has been completed. The libation period is customarily a less formal time than the rest of the circle. Conversation and oftentimes music and dancing, laughing and merriment. Sometimes it gets really crazy depending on what kind of a Sabbat you're in. It's noteworthy that although this can be a very joyful and festive part of the ritual, it's not considered polite to act irreverently, i.e. swearing or roughhousing or disrupting the altar. Discussing subjects of a mundane nature, such as money and gossip and your job and things like that. Save these kinds of discussions to catch up with people afterwards at the feast or the potluck. Okay, so then after you're done with the work and the libations, then it's time to start closing things down. So the salutations and farewell to the deity occur next. If you've called one, you want to make sure and say goodbye. So remember that once you've reached the apex of your ritual, the basic mindset is you walk in and then you back out. So you want to undo your ritual in the reverse order that you did it. So the last thing we did before the work was invoke a deity. Therefore, we're going to say farewell to the deity first as part of taking down the circle. When whoever is in charge decide that it's time to end the circle, they call for order, and all attention is once again turned to the deity's present. Since they have been invoked and not evoked, they are not actually asked to leave. They are instead acknowledged and thanked, and although the circle is ending, they are invited to remain forever in the hearts of all. A common saying is stay if you will and leave if you must. The next thing you're going to do is earth the cone of power. That means you're going to take down the cone of power. I've lost my place here. Hang on a second. I could just do this off the cuff, but I am enjoying reading to you. It's like a bedtime story, right? Okay. The energy that has been raised must be grounded or earthed again before exiting the circle. If this step is accidentally omitted, the energy has a tendency to create irritability, insomnia, and generally everyone leaves with the lack of a sense of completion. So there are many ways of earthing the energy. Usually everyone joins hands again and visualizes the cone. Once again, being coached by a leader, all visualize the tip of the cone receding from the celestial body to which it has been connected. And like melting candle wax, the energy returns to the earth, passing through everyone's body, leaving them feeling recharged, refreshed, and purified. If more grounding is necessary, the participants are instructed to place their hands flat on the floor and ground and let all excess energy drain out through the earth. Now, if you're doing this by yourself, which most of us are that are taking this course, you do that exact same thing, but you're doing it by yourself. You just see it. You see it. You see the cone receding and moving back down into the earth, and you ground all that energy out until you feel no excess energy. Sometimes a cone of power is actually directed to a goal, after which time any excess energy is still earthed. Sometimes the grounding of the cone is combined with a parting dance, but no matter what method, it's everyone's responsibility to make sure that all excess energy is drained out of their own body. Okay, since the elemental forces of the Watchers were evoked, it's important that they be dismissed, and this is a very it's very important that this is a very respectful thing. We're not rude or threatening to them. It's more of an attitude of thank you so much for coming. Have a great trip home. Goodbye. Just like a guest at a party. Whichever watchtower was called first is dismissed first. So the witch stands before the quarter and salutes it with her, I would say her wand, but it says athame in the text. So you make up your own mind. She speaks her dismissal and draws a banishing pentagram in the air with the blade, if you're using a pentagram. Otherwise, you might want to just make a motion like you're closing a curtain. Then she moves around the circle. Now, it says diocel to each quarter. It's also common to close the circle down widdershins. That's the counter sunwise, so counterclockwise in the north, clockwise in the south. It's up to you, but do it in an orderly fashion. She finishes with a silent salute to the direction with which she began. All pause for a moment, visualize the circle with the portals closed. then you banish the energy boundary. For the most part, all energy in a magic circle travels diacel. Occasionally, however, we do move in a Wittershins manner. Once the diacel energy of the cone and quarters has gone, the only energy left of the circle is the circle. So it's the boundary. So we can disperse it by walking either diacel or Wittershins. Diacel is the way that the sun and moon travel, and it symbolizes higher wisdom and evolution. Wittershins is the direction the earth spins, symbolizing the underworld release, banishing, and grounding. If more grounding seems necessary, the circle might be banished Wittershins. Or if the feeling of higher aspiration is desired to continue, the circle may be dispersed diacel. It's purely a matter of personal taste and entirely up to the discretion of the person casting the circle. So the witch will begin exactly as she began casting it, pointing her blade down at the boundary, walking in either direction, slowly seeing the boundary sinking into the earth and dispersing until reaching her starting point while speaking her banishing incantation. Then you do a final grounding and closing. After the circle has been banished, all present take a moment to ground and center silently. The ritual is formally closed either by some spoken words, a song, or a parting dance. Traditional closing is, may the circle be open. That's not how it goes. May the circle be open yet unbroken. May the Lord and the Lady be ever in our hearts. Merry meet and merry part and merry meet again. And there's a little tune that's often used with that. And if you listen to the Craft Music podcast, it's in there. It's a good idea to have the very last gesture be everyone clapping, even if you're by yourself, because clapping is an excellent way of dispersing energy. Once the circle is gone, then it's usually time to have a feast or a party. Okay, now the whole thing is given as a practical exercise. In the handout, and the banishing and evoking pentagrams are part of that support material that's already a part of the handout. So the handout should be up hopefully at the same time that this is up. If not, it'll be up soon. The one thing that you might want to recognize is that the pentagrams in the support material also include a circle around them, and that's another personal taste. Some people like to encircle the pentagrams when they are calling the watchtowers. They feel that creates more of a portal, and it's more of an evocatory stance, whereas without the circle, it's more of an invocational type of stance. It's totally up to you. If you decide to draw the circle around the pentagram, we usually recommend that you draw the circle diacel when you're evoking and Wittershins when you're banishing. And that's all made very clear in that handout. Okay, so I actually got a podcast up. It's a long one because I'm actually going through this line by line with you, giving you my little opinions here. I hope that you don't get intimidated by this because it's actually very easy. If you feel like this circle is too hard for you, you can streamline it, like I said at the beginning, just by doing a simple purification, draw your circle boundary, and that's it. If you want to call the quarters, you don't have to. You do not have to use pentagrams. You can just approach each quarter in turn, and you can say something from the heart if you don't want to use the evocations or the incantations that I give you in the handout. And that's it. And it can take you, 5 minutes. So I recommend as part of your training that you do some kind of circle casting at least once a week for the next 4 weeks. What would be great is if you could commit to doing casting a circle once a day for the next week or two so that you get used to what it feels like. Because casting a circle can be one of the most important parts of creating the right space. And when you're doing certain types of operations, and you'll start to know what these are intuitively, but there's certain kinds of spells and operations that really, really need to be done in a circle. And you don't want to be futzing around with it and wondering how to do it. So the more fluid you can get at casting a circle, the better. All right. So until next time, I hope it doesn't take so long for me to get the next episode up, but this should give you something to work on until then. Again, please send me the questions that you have and either personal message me or email me is even better. Email me directly, ariel@thatdcw.org, if you have a question that you would like for me to put straight onto the podcast. Love and blessings. Until next time. Thank you.